Persistent exposure to death and trauma puts our first responders at risk. This hour, how to tackle those mental health challenges. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we'll learn about the unique stresses faced by firefighters, police officers, paramedics, and other first responders, and how they're getting support for conditions like post-traumatic stress and depression related to their work. Then we examine why interest in becoming a police officer is down dramatically across the country as well as here in Iowa, and what's being done about it. That's all coming up. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, we want to focus on the mental health challenges faced by our first responders, firefighters, police officers, EMTs, paramedics, nurses. Studies and personal stories tell us that police and firefighters have a persistent exposure to death and trauma that can put them at an increased risk of, for instance, post-traumatic stress and depression. You may have heard the recent NPR report that examined how the danger of suicide is particularly acute for law enforcement officers. In fact, and this will probably be a surprise to you, police are more likely to die of suicide than they are to be killed by an assailant. Joining us this half hour, a fire chief and an Iowa police officer to talk about these challenges and what's being done to address the problem. If you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps you are a first responder. Have you noticed a change in the level of support for the mental health challenges associated with your job? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. In our Iowa City studio, Officer Michael Harkrider is with us. He's with the Iowa City Police Department. He's part of that department's crisis intervention training program. Officer Harkrider, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us by phone, a volunteer fire chief, Mark McNeese from the Atlantic Fire Department in western Iowa. Chief McNeese, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. Good to be here.
I want to get your perspectives, first of all, on the nature of the stresses, the unique stresses related to your work as first responders. Let me turn to you, first of all, Officer Harkrider. Help us understand what it's like to be in law enforcement today, particularly the daily stresses that you encounter and the types of stresses that are particularly hard to deal with.
Sure. Well, first off, it's still a very fun job. I love doing it. I do. But it is not without its challenges. And Ben, if you don't mind moving forward, you just call me Mike or Michael. Either one's fine.
Okay.
And that's one of the things that I usually do at work, too, is try to drop the title whenever possible when working with people. But yes, it can be very challenging. For the same reason it's fun, every day is different. You really don't know what you're going to get into every night or day when you get to work and start your shift.
Mm-hmm. We understand. I mean, a lot of your interactions with the community are very pleasant ones,
mm-hmm.
Good ones. But on the other side of the thing, when you're faced with the trauma, an event that's unexpected, what are the types of events that are harder for you and your colleagues to process that you don't forget about once you clock out and go home? What types of events are those?
Well, deaths are difficult, whether they're natural or unnatural. They can be. There's a wide variety of just gore that police and fire and EMTs see that average person just won't see even once in their lifetime, and you might see once a week, once a month, handful of times a year, depending on where you work and what kind of shift you work. And there's not too many people that call us when things are okay, when they say, hey, everything's great, you know, we're having a barbecue, can you stop by and
right.
have a bite to eat? it's typically one of the worst days or worst moments of their lives that we're getting called for. Mm-hmm. And while that's challenging, it is what we signed up for, as people say. But I don't think we, and when I say we, I guess I'll just say myself, you don't know exactly what you signed up for until you're out there.
And experience it. Mm-hmm. You can get a lot of training, but once you you have to have the real experience to understand what kind of pressure and stresses, unique stresses you're under.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Fire Chief McNeese out there in Atlantic, Iowa, give us a sense of the stress that you and your colleagues experience, the fire department.
Well, I agree with Mike on everything he said there, and especially that last one where we come to everybody at their dire need. And I don't think not only is the public not aware of what we see and what we do, I think it also, even though you may have signed up with it, you may have volunteered to do this, until you are out in there and responding, you do not realize what you may be asked to do. And we get asked to do a lot of things that people would never step forward to do. And it can really have an adverse effect, especially if it's your first time on a volunteer or on anybody, or even if you've done it for years, it can start to pile up on you, and that's when you start having potential problems. And our biggest thing is that we don't want to lose people. We spend all this time to, A, get a volunteer, which is difficult anyway, and then to get them trained and outfitted. And, you know, I'm very, very serious and concerned about their health and well-being, number one, but I also don't want to lose somebody mm-hmm. over an incident. So that's why we have really tried to change the culture within the fire service. We've done it here locally. I pushed it statewide when I was in an office where I could do that, you know, we need to use all the tools that are available to us, and they are growing, but we've got to get past that stigma first that, you know, we're all type A's and I don't need help. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
a lot of times you do.
Yeah, let's identify some of those problems right there. Mark McNeese, just to make sure our listeners know, you come with a wealth of experience, nearly 30 years on the fire department, I understand. You've been chief there in Atlantic since 07, past president of the Iowa Firefighters Association. So when you have a new firefighter on the force there with you, what are you watching for? What do you tell them about? Because as Mike here pointed out, you know, until you experience it, you can have a lot of training, but that experience is really where you learn how to cope with it. What are you watching, particularly in new recruits, as warning signs, and what words of advice do you give them?
Well, we make sure that we tell them that, you know, we don't want you to do something you're not comfortable with, number one, but that if you get to a situation, and particularly, as Mike mentioned, you know, we unfortunately see a lot of death or a lot of gore, that if you can't handle it, let us know right then while you're there. And then after the incident, we get together with them and make sure that they know that they have the support with us to get it off their chest if they need to. If it is a big event, it's kind of hard to watch for signs in some people that if they're fairly new, you know, I'm not sure exactly how they always react to things. So we look at, do they look like they lost what they were doing, what their personality was like when they first came in? You know, there are warning signs to watch for. But we tell them, you know, if we have an incident like that, we're going to have a critical stress debriefing. And we will sit down and go through them. And the best thing about those is that you find out that everybody else may have those feelings that you thought it was just you, and you thought maybe you were weak or you were nuts, and you find out you're not, that everybody else is feeling the same thing, but we're there for each other. So, like I said, there's a lot of signs to look out for of somebody that may be having an issue afterwards. You know, have they become angry? Are they impulsive? Are they losing sleep? Are they starting to abuse things? Are they short? You know, their personality changed. Now they snap at everything. Or there's a lot of behavioral that we watch for. In a new person, it's a little more difficult until you get to know them and are around them. In somebody that's been on a while and you've been around a while, it's a little easier to pick up on.
Mm-hmm. without being too graphic, give us a better sense, Mark McNeese, to you again, of what you might face. You tackle their problems, horrific accidents at the Atlantic Fire Department as a group. What would you witness that would follow you after work? Again, without being too graphic, but giving us enough of a sense of what it is like in real terms.
Well, I think that some of the things that you end up doing, you know, in particular, a death is difficult. In particular, children are difficult to respond to. And if something bad happens to them, whether it's medically or if it was a death, obviously in fire, if we respond to that, or the accidents, a lot of times you have to wait for a medical examiner. So you may spend even more time on scene. And then there is a removal process and extrication on scenes from vehicles. You know, it's very difficult to do. You see things, you do things, you have to physically interact with people that, you know, may be alive, may be on their way to death that you know or already there. And those things stick with you. And even though you may have a debriefing afterwards or you've done it many times, down the road in the future, there's anything can trigger that. It could be a sight, it could be a sound, it could be a smell, and that floods back to your memory. That takes you back to that. And so those are the kind of things that you think you're going to be a firefighter, I'm going to go put out a house fire and I'm done. I'm going to put out a grass fire, I'm done. It gets much more involved with that on the things that we call and then or get called to. And even in just some cases, just seeing the conditions that somebody is living in, whether it's, you know, the physical conditions of what they have or are living within that is bad for their health. Maybe they're under, and Officer Michael sees this, I'm sure, much more than we do, you know, abuse, neglect, and that is something that is always going to stick with you that you're not necessarily signing up for, but it becomes, that's your job.
Mm-hmm. Officer Mike Harkrider, Mike, as part of the Iowa City Police Department's Crisis Intervention Training mm-hmm. team, talk a little bit more about the stigma that you're trying to break down here in terms of being able to reach out for help.
Sure.
What is that stigma? How present is it among how many of your colleagues?
It's very present. It's ever present. First off, I mean, Mark commented on a lot of things that I was glad was covered, and I can't imagine having to not only to do this work, but to do it as a volunteer. That's very impressive. Because even though I enjoy my work, if I wasn't also being able to provide for my family while doing it, it would be difficult. Mm-hmm. And he also mentioned something about their first exposure to some of these scary scenes. My very, very first call. I mean, the very first call I ever went on. Was a very violent shotgun suicide. And I say violent, I mean, you can just, I don't need to really give details.
Right.
You can probably imagine it. And the officer that I went there with, he's since retired, but he had been there about 30 years. And I remember the comments he made afterwards were, I don't know, I'd say troubling. Like you could tell he wanted to get it clear to me that I couldn't show any kind of emotion or struggles, even though I wasn't. I thought I wasn't anyway. I thought I was wearing a pretty good poker face. He made it very clear that there was no room for that. And then fast forward a few months later, another officer with the same level of experience, who has also since retired, went to another almost identical scene with me, and it was very different.
How so?
Afterwards, we were very businesslike throughout the entire interaction until later at the hospital. We were going to go in and meet with the family, and he sat me down and made sure I was okay first. Mm. The family was clearly the priority, but he recognized that if I'm not capable of handling this, then what good am I going to be to the family that we're about to go talk to? Mm-hmm. And he made me feel very normal for any kind of feelings, even if I didn't have feelings about it, even if that didn't bother me.
Yeah.
Whatever I was feeling, it's normal. Even if it doesn't feel normal, this isn't normal. So whatever you're feeling from it, you know, is normal.
Yep.
So to see those two sides was wonderful. And through our CIT program, I mean, that's a great program, but my personal involvement in it is the officer well-being and the officer wellness. And to make sure that that our police officers are trying to get past that stigma is what's the biggest thing.
That's the
for
biggest
us.
Hurdle?
I would say so.
What other services do you offer?
So we have recently, when I say we, the Iowa City Police Department has recently started a peer-to-peer program, and that's the base level of if you just want to meet with an officer. It's confidential. There's actually state law that supports us in the confidentiality. So if they say something that a supervisor or commander might find troubling, it doesn't go past us, unless, of course, they're saying things like suicide or, mm-hmm. you know, something that we'd have to get them help for. Or if they just fear what people will think of them, we have a confidentiality agreement that it stays with us. There's also they can meet with professional counselors throughout the year. I think I don't remember the exact number, but so many times a year. And if it goes past that, the insurance does a great job covering it as well.
Mm-hmm. Mark McNeese, before our time gets away from us, we have just over 5 minutes left. I wanted to ask you, with the long view you've had almost 30 years at the fire department there in Atlantic, is that a real generational difference, generally speaking, the degree to which your force members are willing to seek support without that stigma attached?
Well, I agree. You know, we're mostly all type A's, and we don't like to lose. You don't like to show weakness. You think you can handle everything. I think there was much more of a stigma with ones that are more seasoned, I call them, that grew up with that you, as Mike said, you know, you don't show emotion. Don't let this bother you. Well, like we said, we've tried to change that. Some of the younger ones, I think, also have that same attitude. However, they are a little bit more receptive to the fact that it is okay to let us know. We did have one incident here a year or so ago with one that, you know, I had no idea was having an issue, hit it well, but fortunately opened up to somebody, and then we stepped in and got him some resources and some help. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a generational in that, but I still think you have to make it clear to everybody, you know, take them aside, just as Mike said, and let them know whatever you're feeling. You know, if it seems unusual or it starts to bother you or you think you need help, please get in touch with us.
Mm-hmm. Let's quickly go to our phones. Rob is with us in Des Moines. Hi, Rob. Not much time. Sure glad to have you on the phone. What's the point you want to make?
Hey, thank you for having me. I 100% agree that trauma and isolation that our first responders feel is going to be really overwhelming, and that the existing systems of care do not always meet those needs. I think this is a population that sometimes is going to struggle to find good treatment options would kind of be prone to self-medicating for their mental health and trauma needs. American Addiction Centers is my employer, and we offer a salute recovery program. I was wondering if there is local options for mental health and substance abuse treatment for first responders.
Mm. Well, thanks, Rob, in Des Moines. Mike, do you want to tackle that one?
Well, I can speak just from personal experience. When I mentioned being able to talk to a professional counselor, I myself didn't suffer from substance abuse, but I did meet with a counselor several times a couple of years ago that helped me through a troubling time for myself. And the command staff don't know that you're meeting with them. That's kept confidential. I think a big concern amongst law enforcement is, well, if I say I'm struggling with this, are they just going to fire me because they don't want me on the street? And that's not the case.
Right.
And to convince officers and officers, firefighters, EMT, dispatchers, you know, all those first responders that they can seek that assistance is a big hurdle too.
Mm-hmm. At the outset, I mentioned that police are more likely to die of suicide than they are to be killed by an assailant. Mike, can you help us understand what you think is behind that statistic? How do you get to a point as someone who is helping others in their worst times in lives and families to get to a point where you would want to take your own life?
Well, a lot of it's been said, and thanks, Rob, for calling in with that point, and as well as Mark said something earlier about one of his newer officers not showing any signs of struggle. I think a lot of us wear a different face at work than we do at home, so it's really important to have a support system everywhere at work. That's going to be our responsibility to help each other out, and we can't force everyone to have a good support system at home, but we're hoping that's there. But if they don't, then yes, at work, it's going to be on us to be there for each other and to like that officer that that made it clear to me that everything was okay, that it was okay to have feelings about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was career changing for me, because if he would have had the same mentality as the officer
the
a few months
one.
Prior, that might still be instilled in me today.
That's just
how we got to do this.
That there would have been a consistent message. You have to keep this bottled up. That's part of the job.
Right. So, and it sounds like Mark's doing a wonderful job with his position there. But all of us, as we advance through our careers and become the ones that maybe newer officers are looking up to, if we're showing that it's okay to take care of ourselves and that that's important and that, you know, self-care is not selfish, then that's going to spread.
Mm-hmm. Mark McNeese as a fire chief out there in Atlantic. Have you seen things change in your nearly three decades on the fire department, change for the better in these regards?
Yeah, I think it definitely has. And I think it just is because, you know, when I first got on, we didn't have a stress debriefing, never heard of it. And then after a particularly nasty incident, we did have one. There are resources within Iowa. You can look on for critical stress debriefing. They come out, talk to you. There are people that have been within it, whether it's EMS, fire, clergy. I would say chaplains are a great thing that are starting to pop up a little bit more on fire departments here. That gives you a resource as well. So I've seen that change. The National Volunteer Fire Council has come out with a fire and EMS helpline that is free and confidential 24 hours a day. It's called Share the Load. It's a support system for firefighters, EMTs. So, you know, the resources are becoming better, and they're there. It's just a matter of us getting the word to them that use them and take advantage of it, or we'll direct you to them.
Mm-hmm. We've addressed, because it's our focus this half hour, a darker side of your service to our communities. We have a couple minutes left. Mike, Officer Harkrider, I'd like to have you share, where is your joy in your job? Where is the biggest joy that you have in serving your community in Iowa City?
Well, personally, on a selfish note, and I told my lieutenant this the other night, so hopefully he won't be salty if he hears me say it again on the radio, but I think my favorite part is I come to work, I see my bosses for a few minutes, but then I have, you know, what freedom I can have to go make what I want of this career. I get in my car, I set it up, and I go hit the street. And there are going to be calls I get sent to, and I have no choice, you know, and that's fine. I enjoy going to those calls as well, but I can have as much or as little community outreach as I want. And for me, the more the better. Even though I work night shift, I do still find lots of ways to try to engage with our community, and I love that. Mm-hmm. I meet new people every night and form relationships. That it's a big responsibility to know that each impact or each interaction you have with someone is going to be something they remember, and they tell each other, and they tell their friends on social
right.
media, and they make a big deal out of whether it was good or bad. And although that is a big responsibility, I love to carry it.
Volunteer Fire Chief Mark McNeese, leave us with the bright side of your work in the remaining less than a minute.
Well, I agree that the working with the public and doing the fire prevention is probably one of the highlights of all of us, especially during the week in October when we go out to the schools and we work with the kids. We do programs with the public and just, you know, passing along the information on how they can be safe and interacting with them that way. But when we do have a call and when we're out there and have done what I would say is quote-unquote a good job, you know, and you've helped maybe save their property or it's been a good result on a medical call, there's nothing better. There's no better feeling that you helped your fellow man out, and that's why we do it.
Well, we want to thank you for this conversation and both of you and all of your colleagues for first responders for your valuable service to our communities here in Iowa. Thank you very much, Officer Mike Harkrider and Volunteer Fire Chief Mark McNeese in Atlantic. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Be safe.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll examine why interest in becoming a police officer is down dramatically across the country, as well as here in Iowa. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Interest in becoming a police officer is down dramatically across the country. Well, the FBI as well has seen a sharp drop in applications per year. That is before a new marketing campaign brought an upswing to the FBI. Retaining officers, once they've joined is getting harder as well. Let's look at the Iowa angle on this with two in law enforcement here. Iowa City's Johnson County Sheriff Lonnie Pulkrabic is with us in our Iowa City studio. Sheriff Pulkrabic, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Also joining us by phone, Major Joe Leibold is with the Waterloo Police Department, where he's Investigations Division Commander. Major Leibold, welcome to you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about the nature of the problem and what you've noticed in recent years. Sheriff Pulkrabic, start off by describing the extent of this recruitment problem and when you first saw it surface.
Well, I think really in the last 10 years it's come about where we've just seen a noticeable decline in the number of applicants that take the civil service exam. Not only the decline there, but, the thing that I think drives it home is recently we had a civil service exam for deputy sheriff, and we had about 60 applicants or so and about 50 show up for the test. But recently we also had a entry-level clerk position in our records division. So that's a non-sworn Monday through Friday entry-level clerk position. And we had well over 100 applicants for that. And so I think it's, a lot of it is the hours and things like that. Monday through Friday is more appealing to people. Family, time off, and things like that are important. And I think those are some of the driving factors, because when you get in law enforcement, it's nights, weekends, holidays. You may miss some birthday parties. You may miss some sports games and things like that. And there's a lot of pressure put on today's law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. If you could express it roughly in percentage terms over the last 10, if you say 10 years ago is when you first noticed this trend, is you have roughly half the applicants, or is that anywhere near the ballpark?
I would say it's at least half. Yeah, it's been cut over the last 10 to 20 years, the number of applicants.
Major Leibold there at the Waterloo Police Department, describe the problem that you're seeing, and does it coincide with what Sheriff Pulkrabic describes?
Yeah, I think it's very similar. We obviously all recruit from the same candidate pool, so we're seeing similar reductions. We had our last test, we had 55 applicants actually show up to take the test versus, back when I took the test in the early 90s, there was 200 to 300 people showing up. I think the biggest difference for us, though, is that our quality of candidate really hasn't went down. I think our quality of candidate is still outstanding. We're just seeing fewer of them come in the door for a lot of reasons the sheriff mentioned, that we just don't have, people the nights, the weekends, the holidays. We're competing for the same people that can work a Monday through Friday day job at a bank or, in our case, Waterloo John Deere or any of the other corporate employers.
Mm-hmm. Is it because, Major Leibold, do you think it's because the economy is in relatively good shape?
Well, I think that's an indication of it. Obviously, when I came on in the early 90s, the economy wasn't so good and people sought out civil service. I think that's part of it. I think the sheriff alluded to the other part is that, the view on law enforcement is different. The media, TV, the perspective on it is maybe not reality, but that's what people see in that click advertising or that Facebook post or that YouTube video that draws a lot of attention and causes a lot of disruption in family lives. People tend to try to avoid that as well.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that, the perception of the police that is, you would attribute to media coverage of the police. Sheriff Pulkrabic, do you see that as contributing to these declining numbers, a diminished perception of police, particularly after the unrest and the shooting before that in Ferguson, Missouri?
Yeah, a lot of people bring out Ferguson, Missouri as the one go-to where, officers are accused of doing wrongdoing. And it's whenever you see something happen today, people automatically reach for their phone or a camera to video it rather than mm-hmm. actually going and helping the person. But the Ferguson, Missouri case, really is not the case that people who are anti-police should hang their hats on, because, that officer was ruled or deemed to have not done anything inappropriate. But, the race relations, everything today with social media, instant camera type of, people can take video and get it out to 1,000 people within seconds. And all that has sort of brought the attention to law enforcement. When you start looking on a national level and you look at statistics, the number of law enforcement officers that screw up and really screw up is really a very small amount. And most of us, especially us that are in hiring and management, you know, we don't want the bad officer either. We want to weed them out as well. And that's, you know, part of that is why, you know, our hiring process is so difficult to try and prevent some of that. But, you know, there's an unreal expectation brought on by, you know, there's any number of reasons why it's brought on. But we have always had to be jacks of all trade and masters of none. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of just been brought forth even more so by the news media and by you know, social media and things like that.
Right, and I guess in mentioning Ferguson, there was a number of videos after that it related to other incidents where there was wrongdoing on the part of law enforcement officers there. Major Leibold, I wanted to talk a little bit about the what the sheriff mentioned here. Within the last 10 years, everybody's acquired a cell phone, and when you have a scene happening, something happening where law enforcement is involved, are you and your colleagues there in the Waterloo Police Department finding that you have to deal with everybody wanting to record it on their cell phone, and that complicates the situation?
Yeah, we do deal with, you know, cell phone video, and anymore the officers are so accustomed to it. All our officers have worn body cameras for several years now. Between body cameras and car cameras, which have been in the industry for quite some time, they're used to being on camera virtually their whole day. They, as the chief will say, they fill a role. They're actors on a stage. They play a role as a police officer. They work professionally, and they do everything they can. Not to say they don't make mistakes, because mistakes do happen. We are human, but we try to correct those, and as the sheriff alluded to, we try to weed some of those mistakes out in the early hiring process, which is probably another reason we have difficulty hiring. It can take a year to get hired as a police officer, or longer sometimes, by the time you pass all the tests and the physicals and the psychological exams and the polygraph exams. By the time you get through the whole process and you're actually hired, can take up to a year, and people just aren't accustomed to that in today's society. They're used to things that happen a lot quicker and are faster. You know, you apply today, you're hired tomorrow kind of thing, and that's just not a reality in law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Joe Leibold, I wonder if the increase in public and media scrutiny of the police, made possible by the technology, the body cameras that are now a part of every everyday law enforcement, but also the social media that the sheriff mentioned, has that made this profession, this calling, less appealing for some, you think?
Well, I think for some it's probably made it less appealing, and for others it's probably made it more appealing. I think it kind of depends on the person and how they feel about it. Most of the officers, I think almost all of our officers, would prefer to not work without a body camera. They love having the body camera on. If theirs is broken, they quickly get another one. They become very accustomed to it and realize that it is an advantage to us on the street. It protects us. It tells the true story, or at least a good video version of it. It allows us to collect evidence. It's a great tool for us. So I think people in the profession have become accustomed to it and are used to it. I think the media is not so much as a portion of it as the actual media, but just television in general. The television shows and the programs don't always portray law enforcement as an accurate depiction of what we do. And that sometimes is misleading. I have a daughter who asked about becoming a CSI, and she thought it was like CSI on TV. And I'm like, yeah, it's nothing like that. You know, that's not how it works. And people have that misconception that, you know, CSI on TV or NYPD or all the television shows are reality, and they're not. I mean, if they're curious about the profession, they need to come. They need to ride along. They need to get to know officers and spend some time and see what it's like actually doing the work. And I think a lot of people find it enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Mayor Joe Leibold is with us of the Waterloo Police Department, as well as Johnson County Sheriff Lonnie Pokrovic. We're talking, having our conversation revolve around the fact that interest in becoming a law officer, a police officer, is down across the country, also here in Iowa. You've been hearing the sheriff and Major Leibold talk about how there's been a sharp drop in applications over the past 10 years for law enforcement positions. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. Well, let's talk a little bit about how you've been reacting to this smaller pool of applicants, maybe countering some of the mischaracterizations, Sheriff Pokrovic, that you see out there portrayed on TV, in the news media, or in TV dramas that portray law enforcement?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Major Leibold hit on one of the big things. You know, the CSI shows on TV, it's so unrealistic, you know, for the general public. They fall into that, like, you should be able to do this. This should be really easy to resolve. Because on TV, they have the crime, they investigate the crime, they prosecute the crime, and they convict the defendants all within our time scope, including your commercials, you know. So that creates that unrealistic, you know, when you have a serious crime, it takes a lot of time to investigate it and a lot of resources. But getting back to the recruiting thing, one of the things that's glaring as well is our civil service exams and our lists, our hiring lists that we go off of. Normally, by law, by statute, they're good for 2 years. The last five that we've had all only lasted 1 year in time. And prior to that, we'd never had a list really expire. We'd always went to that 2 years and then we would retest. And so that's another indicator that, you know, Major Leibold touched on that we compete for the same people. And that really is true, you know, for most of Iowa, we're competing for that small, we're competing with all the law enforcement agencies for those small pools. So that, you know, that goes to it. I want to touch one more thing on the body cameras. The other thing that it does is it allows people to second guess this occupation. There's few occupations out there that people that are not trained and not have no expertise in the occupation, but yet they have a lot of comment and a lot of input on what we do for a living daily.
Okay, maybe not a realistic perception. they haven't walked in your shoes.
Right.
Okay, let's go to a caller before the hour ends. Nick is with us in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the conversation. What do you want to chip in?
Hi there. My question, and this is a public perception question, really the role of police, and there's a lot of scrutiny around the militarization of police, and I don't know if that's so much at the local level, but certainly it's a national conversation point. I would love to hear your guest's take on that and really what's happening, trends over the last couple decades.
Mm. Okay. Who would like to tackle that? Major Leibold, can I hand that to you?
Sure. You know, there is some, I can't say militarization of, but we do share similar roles at times, whether it's protecting the public or providing order. The weaponry on the street has increased over the years. We used to take revolvers and Saturday night specials, for lack of a better term, off the street. Now you're seeing 9mm and assault rifles and a lot more things. There's a lot more weapons in society in general. So law enforcement has had to evolve for that, which includes external body armor, special equipment. We've been asked to do more. The sheriff alluded to a jack of all trades, master of none. We've been asked to do more as far as on a terrorism front. Not, you know, that's prevalent in Iowa on a wholesale, but we do have to provide some homeland security issues. So there is some. I think we're trying to balance the community nature versus, you know, officer safety in general and public safety, and that's a tough balancing act for any agency to perform.
Mm-hmm. Major Leibold, to you there in Waterloo. Waterloo, of course, a diverse community. If I can paraphrase something from the Washington Post article recently on this topic, the article mentioned that African-American students were often deterred by family members who were, quote, not too hot on the idea of a relative becoming a cop, and a misunderstanding of how often officer-involved shootings occur. I wonder if you face that as well in Waterloo, that particularly with minority groups, that when you strive for diversity, to have a police force that reflects the diversity of your community, whether that's now become an extra challenge.
Well, I think, you know, the minority community, the African-American community, mother not being all overly enthused about her son being able to become a police officer is probably not unique. I think if I asked my mother today, the answer would probably be no. I wasn't too thrilled about it at the time. You know, it's a profession not everybody is designed for, and not everybody understands. So I'm not from a law enforcement family. I'm the only person in my family in law enforcement. And at times I think there's a little like, wow, I why do you do that? Go do something else. Do something safer. So I don't think that's unique to the African-American community. And when I started in this profession a long time ago, a chief in a small town told me, you know, don't police where you live. That's just, it's hard to do. You have to deal with too many high school classmates and friends and relatives. We have a lot of officers here that grew up here, and they do a very fine job of it. But when you're talking the African-American community, that's a smaller, closer, tighter-knit community, and that makes it even more difficult to police in Waterloo. So as we recruit minority candidates, recruiting from within the city becomes difficult on a variety of tasks. And the other side of that is corporations and businesses are recruiting for the same talent. They're after the same talent, and as we've said, you know, they offer Monday through Friday, day shift, holidays off, weekends off. They have a lot more freedom and family time and leisure time, at least on the front. So I think that all plays a role into it.
Mm-hmm. In the final 5 minutes of this conversation, I'd like to have the two of you with your views look to the future and see how do you think law enforcement will be shaped by these current times, by this trend. Sheriff Pokrovic, is this, for instance, the decrease in applications, is this still sustainable to get the quality workforce, public service officers that we need in law enforcement?
Well, I think the major touched on this as well. You know, we're still getting quality candidates. We're just getting a lot fewer of them. And so I don't think we have a choice but to make it sustainable for the near future. I think, you know, people are finding different ways to recruit, different ways to reach out, using social media more. You know, in fact, when we recruit, we use Facebook and pay to put advertisements on there to recruit on social media and target certain areas. It's amazing what you can do. But, you know, a lot of law enforcement agencies are creating videos, recruitment videos and things like that to make it look, you know, our occupation look more fun, more interesting, things like that. Anything that's different to draw interest is good. You know, talking about trying to recruit and make your agency diverse, that is not only a nationwide thing, it's a statewide thing, it's a localized thing. All law enforcement administrators would like to make their agency look more diverse, but it's a challenge. Typically, you're talking about white males is the majority of the population that become police officers in law enforcement, mm-hmm. and that's a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Major Leibold, what do you see when you look to the future, the next 5-10 years?
Well, I think he touched on a little bit. We do have to recruit differently. We have to be more active on social media. We have to be more active with the recruitment videos and things like that. And our last recruitment process, we did a test or a survey of the applicants who actually showed up to the testing and found out how they heard about us and why they came. And then we did a post reach out to the people who applied but didn't show up and asked them, hey, why weren't you here? What caused you to miss it? Mm-hmm. And we need to listen to that feedback. And some of it's stuff we don't control. It's, you know, state law requires you to be able to pass this fitness test. And we lose a fair number of people who say, hey, I can't pass. But some stuff we can't control, time, data test, things like that, how we market, how we advertise. But we learned our probably biggest recruiting advantage, and I would guess this is probably statewide, is the officers themselves reaching out to people and saying, hey, you should look at this profession. You should do this. And, you know, college classmates or high school friends or whatever. And that most of our applicants, the majority of them at that time, had said that they either heard about us online through social media, not through the traditional newspaper like we used to do, and or from an officer that actually works here and told them that, you know, hey, you should think about this. Look at this job, you know, right. Facebook shares or that kind of stuff.
And probably often countering misperceptions of the career, Sheriff Pokrovic. What are the chief misperceptions? Okay, it's not like CSI. We know that.
Well, not only that, but, you know, I think there's a perception that police officers are something different than human, you know, and that we, a lot of times cops on the street, they don't show any emotions and they try, you know, generally to try to be professional. And I think at times the public looks at them as almost like they're robotic because they just go through the motions. But, you know, that's sort of a protection type of mode. You know, they just want to get their job done and do their job. And people look at them, they see the uniform you know, I think that it creates a perception of oh, a little bit, you know, hey, let's stay away from them because they got a uniform on.
Right. Major Leibold, I've always wondered, too, when you put, of course, of our law enforcement are just humans, right? They go home and put on civilian clothes. But when you do get in a squad car with that uniform on, you experience a different reality in your community, don't you?
Well, it is, and I've been doing this job for going on 30 years at this point, and I will say that I've never been thanked more in my career than I have been in the last 5 years. I think the perception that people don't respect the profession or appreciate the profession, we are constantly getting thanked and told thank you, and people understand that this is a difficult job. It's a hard job, and we do have a lot of public support and a lot of public respect. So I think that's important for people to realize that we're not, you know, we're not running around getting bashed all day long. I am thanked daily by someone, whether it's when I'm getting gas or stopping at the grocery store on the way home or whatever. Someone will say, "Hey, thanks, Joe, for what you do." You know, they're appreciative. It's a common theme anymore. It wasn't always that common when I started on the job. I think people kind of took us for granted. But some of the negative media coverage and some of the other stuff, I think, has made people realize how difficult this job can be.
Mm-hmm. And it's become, would you agree, Joe Leibold, it's become more nuanced, more complicated with the introduction of technology and social media.
Oh, I would agree that I think social media has changed just about every aspect of society today. I mean, not just law enforcement, but from any career, any occupation, social media, I'm sure, has had an impact on them.
All right. Very good. We'll leave it there. Thank you both for joining us. Major Joe Leibold with the Waterloo Police Department, Investigations Division Commander, and Johnson County Sheriff Lonnie Pokrabic. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Tomorrow on the program, it's a Politics Wednesday. President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden have spent weeks jabbing at each other from a distance. This week, they're both in Iowa. We're going to talk about that tomorrow, among many other things, with our political scientists, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Politics Wednesday tomorrow on the program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. It's a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.